We began the service with some joyful songs that the choir led in presenting, they gave us a sense of the feeling of Palm Sunday and the joy that happened when that crowd was crying out, proclaiming Jesus as King, Messiah. And then we came to the place where we're singing, "Were you there when they crucified my Lord?" And you're thinking, wow, what a change in emotional feeling. That is a great description of what happened that week. So quickly, within just a few days, everything turned from Palm Sunday to Good Friday. A major transition took place. And from anyone looking at this from the outside, proclaiming Jesus as King to then condemning him as a criminal, how did things unravel so quickly? How did it go from him being the Messiah, who everybody was excited about, to suddenly being a criminal who is crucified? But there is good reason for us to talk about the crucifixion, even on Palm Sunday. Ray Vanderland, who many of you are familiar with through his film series there, notes that it was on Palm Sunday that Jews traditionally picked out their lamb to be slaughtered for Passover, because Passover would begin just a few days after that Palm Sunday. And Jesus is our Passover lamb who took our punishment on the cross. John Stott, for years, was the rector to the Queen of England, Great Britain, and well-known Christian author. In his book, The Cross, said Jesus had predicted that he would be betrayed into the hands of men or handed over to be crucified. And the Gospels tell us exactly that. The evangelists tell us their story in such a way to show how his prediction came true. First of all, Judas handed him over to the priests. Out of greed, Judas did that. Next, the priests handed him over to Pilate. And the priests did that out of envy of Christ. And then Pilate handed him over to the soldiers out of cowardice. Pilate didn't want to upset the crowds, so he handed Jesus over to the soldiers, who then crucified him. So this morning we want to take a few moments. We've been going through the book of Luke, and we want to take a few moments to look at a passage together surrounding the cross, events surrounding the cross. And I invite you to have a Bible open with me, if you would, to Luke chapter 23, as we look at five different events here and some important lessons that we learn from some of these events surrounding the cross. The first is the concern about the cross. And beginning there in verse 26, we read these words: "As they led Jesus away, they seized Simon from Cyrene, who was on his way in from the country, and they put the cross on him and made him carry it behind Jesus. A large number of people followed him, including women who had mourned and wailed for him." Now, Jesus was being led away to be crucified. Remember, over the last couple of weeks, we had talked about the trial of Jesus and the various verdicts that different ones gave about who Jesus was, rejecting him, and now he is going to be taken out to be crucified. And Luke summarizes things well. The other gospel writers sometimes give us extra details, but Luke gives us a summary, and yet Luke includes things sometimes that others don't. But as they're leading him away, Luke tells us that they take a guy by the name of Simon from Cyrene and force him to help Jesus carry the cross. The cross, an entire cross, was typically up to 300 pounds. Now, it's likely that Jesus wasn't carrying the whole cross. It's likely that he was just carrying the cross beam. It was very common for them to just have the criminal carry the cross beam itself, but that cross beam upon which he would be nailed and then hoisted up was itself anywhere from 75 to 125 pounds. Now, in light of that, you could think, well, he should be able to carry that. You remember that he had been beaten to a pulp. Before that, Jesus had gone through the excruciatingly severe Roman flogging. 39 lashes, 40 minus 1. And the lashes ripped the back open of the person who had that done, because it used all kinds of little sharp metal and glass and various. And the goal of that was to just pulverize the back of a person in excruciating pain. So it's no wonder many times a person would be brought near death. Some even died during the flogging itself. It's no wonder that Jesus would not be able to carry that cross very far. Luke doesn't tell us this, but apparently Christ was not able to carry that. And for that reason, the soldiers grabbed Simon from Cyrene. Now, who is Simon from Cyrene, this guy coming in from the country? Well, Cyrene was an ancient Greek-Roman colony in North Africa. In fact, it is today in modern Libya, not far from Tripoli. It is about 800 miles from Jerusalem. In other words, Simon from there had made quite a journey for Passover. He had come from a distance. In Cyrene, there was a fairly hefty Jewish population, and Simon apparently had come to Jerusalem for Passover. We don't know how long he had been there, but he was coming into the city at this point and probably stood out. It's thought that in general, the population of Cyrene was largely African, so he would have been a man of color. He would have probably had a darker skin and probably stood out in that Jewish population. We don't know why they picked him other than he was there and probably appeared like a foreigner. So they inscripted him and they forced him. The word makes it clear that they didn't give him any choice in this matter. They made him carry this cross. We don't know a lot about Simon of Cyrene, but think about his position there. He did one of the last kind acts that someone would do for Jesus, helping carry that cross for him. By the way, Mark mentions Simon as the father of Alexander and Rufus. And some 35 years later, when Paul was writing the gospel or the epistle to the Roman Christians there, he mentioned Rufus and sending greetings to Rufus and his mother. And Paul mentions his mother had been a mother to me also. All we can do is conjecture because we don't know. But it very well may be that on this day when Simon carried Jesus' cross, he was so affected by all that went on. At some point, apparently, he became a Christian, his wife became a Christian, and his boys became Christians, because Rufus was well known in the church to Paul and his mother. This event here was a concern that Jesus wouldn't be able to make it there by the soldiers. They just simply wanted to carry out their task. But Simon, what he did was no small task. Now, they're going along the road here, and we read what happened after this. There were women who mourned and wailed for him. These women are not named here. There were was a large number of people, and probably a good number of people who felt sympathy for Jesus. Again, this crucifixion that took place here, there were crowds crying out, "Crucify," but there were many, many who didn't want to see Jesus crucified. And now, on the way to the execution, you have both making up the crowd. Both those who wanted to see him crucified and those who did not want to see him crucified. And these women very well could have been some that he had ministered to personally. We don't know. We're not given their names. But he does address them. Verses 28 through 31, we read that Jesus turned and said to them, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me. Weep for yourselves and for your children. For the time will come when you will say, 'Blessed are the barren women, the wombs that never bore, and the breasts that never nursed.' And then they will say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if men do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it is dry?" This was Jesus' last teaching lesson before the cross. And he's speaking it to women who were weeping and wailing for him. Interesting, Jesus' statement. Daughters of Jerusalem, apparently representative of the city of Jerusalem. And notice what his statement, his command to them is. "Don't weep for me, weep for yourselves and for your children." Why would Jesus say that? Probably because they had the focus on the wrong thing. What they were looking at was Jesus' immediate situation, and they saw this innocent man going through such great suffering. And you know, when we stop to think about that, if you've been to the Passion of the Christ in the movie theater, or you've seen it on video, you've seen the amazing description of what Christ went through on our behalf, it can break your heart. It can make your eyes well up with tears. It can make you cry. And these ladies saw what Jesus was going through, and they responded with this. But Jesus suddenly turns their attention away from him to their situation. And it's so interesting how he does this. He goes on and tells them, my situation is not as bad as your situation is. Charles Spurgeon, a British preacher in the 1800s, said, you need not weep over the crucifixion, but weep over your own transgression. For your sins nailed the Redeemer to the accursed tree. And then he went on to say, to weep over a dying Savior is to lament the remedy. It were wiser to bewail the disease. In other words, what Jesus is doing is providing the medicine. Don't weep over the medicine. Weep over the disease. That's where the real problem is. And he goes on to talk with them about what's going to happen to them. The daughters of Jerusalem, representing Jerusalem. And he gives this description, verse 29. The time will come when you will say, blessed are the barren women. Blessed are those who have never had kids. I know normally kids were seen as a great blessing. Why would that be a good time? Because the times are going to get so difficult that parents will wish that their kids had not been born rather than go through what they're going to go through. The times are coming for Jerusalem that the suffering will be so great you will wish the mountains could fall on you and cover you and hide you. Jesus is no doubt referring to the events that would occur 40 years later when Jerusalem would be destroyed by the Roman army. In those days when the Romans invaded Jerusalem, Josephus tells us that there were mass crucifixions that went on. Here we have Jesus and two thieves being crucified, but in that day there were mass crucifixions. As they surrounded the city of Jerusalem and cut off all food going in to the city, there was starvation, there was cannibalism, there was amazing suffering. People were trying to flee and being killed. And Jesus saw all of this before it ever came. And he was giving them words that would raise their eyes far beyond this particular circumstance. Jesus said, you see me here suffering now, but don't weep for me. Weep for that which is really the cause of this and that which is coming. And, you know, I was thinking about the way that Christ dealt with them. And probably would deal with me and this world the same way in saying, don't weep for these things that are the remedy here for him. Rather, weep for that which is the real cause of suffering in this world, our sin. Weep for that. And Jesus goes on and makes an interesting statement here, verse 31. It's a bit of a puzzle here. He says, if men do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it is dry? What's he referring to? Well, he doesn't give the application here, but most think it probably has something to do with this. If the Roman army is cruel to an innocent man, think what they will do to you when you are ripe for judgment. In other words, if they will do this to Jesus who did good, deeds of good, what will they do 40 years later to the Jews who rebel against them continually? If this happens when the tree is green, what will happen when the wood is dry? In other words, the fires of judgment are going to blaze. What Jesus was saying to these women is, your concern over me going to the cross here, you need to see the real problem. And I think that's probably true for us also. The problem, we remember the cross, but the cross isn't the problem. The cross is the solution. Jesus' suffering isn't the problem. Jesus' suffering is the solution. The problem, the real disease, is what we as mankind, what we do to ourselves, and what the people of Jerusalem had done to themselves. Now, there's another event as this continues on. We read in verse 32 about criminals on the cross. Two other men, both criminals, were also led out with him to be executed. Verse 32. Now verse 33. When they came to the place called the Skull, there they crucified him along with the criminals, one on the right and the other on his left. Frederick Farr, theologian in the 1900s, talked about crucifixion in general terms. He said that death by crucifixion seems to include all the pain and death that it can have in a horrible and grisly manner. Dizziness comes, cramps, thirst, starvation, sleeplessness, traumatic fever, shame, the publicity of shame, long continuance of torment, the horror of anticipation, the mortification of intended wounds, all intensified just up to the point at which the body could endure it, but all stop short of the point that would cause the sufferer to lose consciousness and then find relief. In other words, he was saying crucifixion was designed to give maximum torment. The unnatural position of crucifixion made every movement painful, while each variety of misery went on gradually increasing until almost intolerability of burning and raging thirst. And he said one thing is clear. First century executions were not like modern day executions, for they didn't seek a quick and painless death or to preserve any measure of dignity like we do today when there is capital punishment. Rather, first century executions sought agonizing torture that completely humiliated the victim. And it's important that we understand this, for it helps us realize the agony that Christ submitted himself to. When you come to this cross here, Jesus is brought to the cross with two criminals. Matthew and Mark call them two thieves. We don't know what their crime was, but it does remind us that this was all part of fulfilling prophecy. Isaiah chapter 53, 700 years before Christ, speaking about Jesus, said, "He was numbered with the transgressors. He bore the sin of many. He interceded for the transgressors." He was numbered with these transgressors. And this passage tells us that he was brought to Golgotha. The Latin term is Calvaria, from which we get Calvary, and it means skull. Now, we have a couple of pictures I'd like to just briefly show. We don't know the exact place. There are two possible places, but this was one place that was seen as possible Golgotha. You can see this hill. It's interesting, the location of this is at a busy crossroads of streets. Today, if you go to Jerusalem and look at this place. Now, we have a second picture. It shows a little bit closer. It gives you an idea why it was called the skull. You can almost see the face there, the eyes, and if this was the place. It may have been. There's another spot that is a more traditional site. We don't know. In fact, we don't even know why it got the name the skull. Many have assumed through the years because maybe it looked like a skull. It was an outcropping like a skull. Others have said, no, maybe it wasn't even on a hill itself, because Scripture doesn't mention a hill. It may have gotten the term from being an execution place, the skull. We don't honestly know. But Jesus was brought to this place, this dismal place, and he was brought there with two criminals, crucified between two thieves. Christian author John White tells a story of when he was a medical student. He said for one of his classes, he missed a practicum about venereal disease, and he had to make it up by going to the clinic. So he went to the clinic, and he arrived at the clinic, and he ended up in a line with a bunch of patients who had actually contracted venereal disease. Now, John White said, I tried to barge up to the front of the line and tell the lead nurse, I want to see the doctor. I'm here to... But before I could finish my story, she says, "That's what everybody says. You want to see the doctor. Now get in line." And he said, "But wait, you don't understand. I'm a medical student." And he said, "Get in line." Well, he had to wait a while in that line. He said, the nurse responded to him and said, "Big deal. You got it the same way everybody else got it. Now you can stand in line like everybody else." And here he's this medical student. They're just trying to make up this class on venereal disease, not get a shot or whatever for venereal disease. But he said, "As I was standing in line," he said, "it gave me this strong sense of shame." He said, in fact, to this day, as he wrote this book, he said, "I can still feel the sense of shame that made me balk at standing in the line with others who had venereal disease." And he said, "It gave me a sense of what Jesus did. Jesus shunned the shame. He went to the cross between two thieves." And he wasn't on the way saying, "But I'm innocent. I'm not a thief." He wasn't trying to argue that. He just took his place there between two thieves and was executed like a criminal. Why? Because he identified with those he came to save. He was treated as a criminal. He took the guilt of mankind upon him, and he didn't try to get rid of it. He took it, and he suffered with it. The message of these criminals is a message that Jesus, out of tremendous love, identified with us. Identified with us at our worst, with sin. Took our guilt. Huge lesson. And then in the midst of that, compassion. Verse 34. And Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." This is a prayer for the forgiveness of his killers. It is directed to his heavenly Father. And who is he referring to here? Forgive them. Well, I would assume he's referring to the Jewish leaders who sought his crucifixion. I would assume he's referring to the Roman soldiers who carried out his crucifixion. Both Jews and Gentiles needed forgiveness. But notice, he is asking his Father to forgive them. And the reason he gives is they do not know what they are doing. H.G. Wells wrote a story entitled "The Country of the Blind," and in that story he tells about a hidden valley shut off from the rest of the world by high cliffs. And the valley was inhabited only by blind people, and no one there had ever been able to see. And a lost and weary traveler happened to stumble into this valley, this country of the blind, and he stayed with them for a while. They were very kind to him. He lived among them. He found himself falling in love with a young blind maiden in this valley. Remember, everybody was blind. And he began to consider the possibility of marrying this young maiden who is blind. But the rest of the blind people thought this man who could see was strange. They felt that his mind was cluttered and confused, distracted by his ability to see. So they insisted that if he wanted to continue living among them, that he would have to have his eyes put out and become blind like they were. And for a while, the man thought that he'd be willing to do that. But one morning, he got up and he saw the beauty of the sunrise and the mist rising from the valley floor and the dew glistening on the petals of the flowers. And he realized he could not stay in the country of the blind any longer. So he climbed out of the valley and returned to the world of sight. In other words, they didn't realize they were blind. And he almost forgot it until he had that beautiful morning that he saw, and then he remembered what he saw. When Jesus cried out from the cross, "Father, forgive them, they do not know what they are doing," he was giving us a glimpse of our situation, my situation, situation for mankind. We don't know what we're doing. These who were killing Jesus did not realize he was really the Messiah, the Son of God. They were putting him to death. They had no idea the tremendous crime they were committing in doing that. And Jesus prayed in light of that. "Father, forgive them." Now, do you think Jesus' Father answered that prayer? Isn't that interesting? We don't stop to think, did Jesus get an answer to that prayer? "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing." Usually we think, well, they should have known what they were doing. Of course he won't forgive them. But that wasn't his desire. His desire was that they be forgiven. It is a tremendous picture of the compassion of Christ. How far does the compassion of the Savior go to you, to me? Is he compassionate toward you when you're obedient? Sure. Is he compassionate to you when you're trying to do the best you can and you fail and fall short? You don't want to, but you sin? Sure, he's compassionate to you. What about when you think you know a better way and you knowingly disobey him? Is he compassionate toward you then? Absolutely. They thought they knew the way and they were putting him to death. You can't get much more disobedient than that. And it had happened for the Jewish leaders because of the pride that they had allowed their religion to produce in them. It happened to the Roman soldiers who mocked Jesus because of their simple dedication to their duty. But in either case, they didn't know what they were doing. And Jesus' prayer was based upon that. "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing." What a prayer of compassion. When we sin, when we blow it, isn't it true that our most natural response is to shy away from God? I don't want to talk to him. I don't want to go to church. I don't want to. And yet, it is at that point Jesus prayed, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. It is such a unique prayer. Someone has said, on a cross, you curse. On a cross, you scream. On a cross, you cry out because you experience pain on a cross. But you certainly don't pray to forgive others on a cross. Yet, there he hung on a cross praying for others, praying for their forgiveness. His compassion, it's amazing, a huge lesson from the cross. Verse 24 continue, or 34 continues on, and they divided up his clothes by casting lots. It was pretty traditional for the Roman soldiers to divide up the clothes of the condemned man, and you remember that account. And Jesus had his undergarment that was seamless, woven from top to bottom, that they cast lots for. And yet, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. This last Founders Week here, one of the gentlemen that spoke at Founders Week was a guy by the name of Ray Pritchard. I enjoyed reading Ray Pritchard's. He was had been a pastor in the Chicago area for years, and I've enjoyed reading a number of his writings for years. And Ray Pritchard tells about one of the events earlier in his ministry. He said, I got a phone call. On the other end, a man said, Pastor Ray, could I come to see you? And he went on to tell me this story. He said, my wife left me for another man. When she got tired of him, she decided to come back to me, and everything seemed fine for a few weeks. And then she left me again for the same man and stayed with him for a while. And then she came back a second time, and I thought everything was fine. And then she left me again, and she's been with him for a while. And she just called me up and said, I want to come back. And this voice on the other end said, Pastor, I'm not sure I want her back. I can trust somebody once or even twice, but I'm not sure I can trust someone for a third time. How do you forgive the unforgivable? And then he goes on to tell a woman sat in my office and said, I think I'm going to kill myself. And I said, why? And she said, I don't have any reason to live anymore. And this lady went on to tell me the story of how all of her friends had deserted her. How she couldn't get a job, how she didn't have any money, how everything she valued in this world was gone. And then she went on and told me about her children, how they had deserted her, and how they couldn't care less what happened to her. She told me this. She said, Pastor, when I told my son that I was thinking about killing myself, he said, Mom, why don't you just go ahead and do it and get out of our hair? How do you forgive the unforgivable? Then he went on and told about another man who looked at me and said, Pastor, you wouldn't believe what I've been through. He told me a story that I found hard to believe. It involved a brutal divorce after many years of marriage, financial collapse, loss of a job, end of his career, lies behind his back that wrecked his reputation, and people who he had trusted who stabbed him in the back. And then he looked at me and he said, Pastor, you want to know what the worst of it is? The people who have done this to me are Christians. How do you forgive the unforgivable? How do you forgive the unforgivable? We recognize that people, like Jesus said, and we're some of them, we don't know what we're doing. And we can forgive the unforgivable because Jesus has forgiven the unforgivable in us. A huge lesson from the cross is very, very personal. And it asks us this question, is there anyone you cannot forgive? How do you forgive the unforgivable? There's a fourth event from the cross, the contempt because of the cross. Verse 35, the people stood watching, and the rulers even sneered at him, and they said, he saved others, let him save himself, if he is the Christ of God, the chosen one. This was a general group of people just observing the cross. And then the rulers would have been the Jewish leaders who were mocking him. Let him save himself if he is the Christ of God, the chosen one. You notice the two titles they use, the Christ of God, the chosen one. In other words, if he's really so special, look at him on the cross. That sure is special, isn't it? Verse 36, the soldiers also came up and mocked him. They offered him wine and vinegar and said, if you're the king of the Jews, save yourself. In other words, if you are who you say you are, then prove it. Verse 38, there's a written charge, a written notice above him which read, "This is the King of the Jews." You remember Pilate had that written. And the Jewish leaders wanted to have it changed, so it said, no, say this, "He said, I am the King of the Jews." And Pilate said, "What I have written, I have written." And they left it like this. Many think that Pilate did that just to stick it to the Jewish leaders. But it was put up there as a mockery, even though it was true. This is the King of the Jews. And then the mocking continues. Verse 39, the contempt. "Even one of the criminals who hung there with him hurled insults at him. 'Aren't you the Christ? Save yourself and us.'" Have you noticed anything common about all of those mocks, all of the sarcasm? "If you are the Messiah, save yourself and us." In this case, for the criminal. "If you are the Messiah, save yourself." There's an irony in this. By the very fact that he refused to save himself, he was saving us. The very reason that he did not save himself was so that he could save us. The contempt of the cross shows we don't know what is going on. What we see here, as Daryl Bach from Dallas Seminary has said, is vindictiveness face to face with compassion. I was reading about the man who captured Eichmann. There was a movie made out of that with Robert Duvall about the notorious Nazi Adolf Eichmann. He was captured in Argentina, and the story goes on, and the movie goes on and portrays this pretty well. Gives up one scene where he is being interviewed by one of his captors there, and Eichmann tells this man that, "I was simply under oath as an SS officer. That's why I did what I did. And I had nothing personally against the Jewish people." He had overseen, you know, the killing of millions of Jews. But Eichmann is saying, I was simply being obedient to Hitler. And I simply was trying to do my duty. And when the Führer said, "Kill the Jews," you killed the Jews. But then Eichmann went on and clarified. He said, "But I didn't actually kill any Jews. Now, I was in charge of transportation. Nothing more. My sole responsibility was the shipment and transportation and organizing the trains." And the fellow who was interviewing him, a fellow by the name of Maxie, had an incredulous look on his face, stood up and said, "But you knew where those trains were going. You knew that you were sending millions of people to camps." And Eichmann responded and said, "Yes, I knew that, but..." And he went on, Maxie said, "You knew that those camps had gas chambers and crematories. You knew that every Jew you shipped there would be gassed or shot or starved or worked to death. You knew that." And Eichmann responded and said, "That's not my province. Once the shipments were complete, my responsibility ceased. My duties ended at the gates to the camp. Besides, hundreds of thousands survived. I had nothing to do with the concentration camps." Well, what it shows is that Eichmann never took responsibility for his actions. He always saw himself as innocent of the murder of the Jews. Of course, he was convicted, executed, but in his mind, as best we know, people here at the cross took no responsibility, contempt for Christ. Contempt because he didn't display his power in saving himself, and yet by doing that, he was saving us. One last event from the cross, it is the conversion from the cross. Verse 40, "But the other criminal rebuked him. 'Don't you fear God? Since you are under the same sentence, we're punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong. Don't you fear God?' He freely admits his own guilt. He has a fear of God that we are responsible to God. He expresses that. He proclaims Jesus' innocence. In other words, he took responsibility. It was unique. And it had to be unbelievable for the people standing around the cross to hear this conversation going on. And then in verse 42, he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Now think about that statement. His plea was one for mercy. He had just admitted his guilt. We deserve what we're getting. And yet, in his guilt, he asked Christ to remember him for good. That is a display of humility and confession. It's also a display of faith. He's saying, I believe that you're coming into a kingdom. Will you remember me in your kingdom? He was exercising faith. And Jesus answered him, verse 43, I tell you the truth, today you will be with me in paradise. The response to this guy was tremendous news. This thief on the cross has stood through history as an example of the tremendous hope that we have. As long as there is breath, there is the opportunity to humble ourselves before God and trust Him for His forgiveness. And this man, that day, would be with Christ in paradise. There was a lengthy interview with Larry King years ago. Larry King was fixated on dying, this was just a year ago, fixated on dying, and he talked about how he has been thinking about death a great deal. In fact, he said his wife tells him to knock off talking about dying all the time. And he said that he started to think through the preparations he had made with his family, and he realized, when these things are carried out, I won't actually be there. And I won't be around. In fact, in this conversation, when we were talking about preparations for when I'm gone, it hit me that I am still trying to avoid death. But he took comfort in this, that he had made plans to have his body frozen at the point of death, so that hopefully at some point in the future, when they find a cure for the illness that he has, that or from what he died from, that maybe he could be revived and healed. He said, at least I have some hope. Other people have no hope. Is that true? Is that true that other people have no hope? Every civilization throughout history has been shaped by its hope in what is to come. It is no mistake that civilization after civilization, Peruvians, Polynesians, Native Americans, Babylonian Gilgamesh epic, and Babylonian, ancient Babylonian writings, every civilization has some hope in the afterlife, ancient Egypt. Does that mean simply that mankind has this need that they are making up things? Or does it show the unifying testimony of the human heart throughout history in the belief in an afterlife, because there is really something there? There is a God-given innate sense that we were made for something more than just this world. And this account that we've read today is Jesus' statement on that. Today you will be with me in paradise. The concern, the criminals, the compassion, the contempt, the conversion. We look at all of these events around the cross, and they basically can be summarized in three thoughts. One is mankind's situation is desperate. We don't know what we're doing, but the Son of God does. And out of tremendous compassion, He acted to save the human race. And humanity, every person, at whatever point in their lives, realizing that, can cry out to Him in a very simple statement from the heart, like this thief, remember me, and they will be with Him in paradise. That's the good news from the cross. Let's pray together.